I'm Richard Hefner, your host on The Open Mind. We've just recorded in the studio a From the Editor's Desk program with Benjamin Hooks, the executive director of the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. And I've asked Mr. Hooks to stay in place a bit so that here on The Open Mind, we might move on from the immediate considerations of a weekly news show to the longer-range concerns of this more leisurely-paced examination of men and ideas. Mr. Hooks, welcome to The Open Mind.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for staying here. And let me begin by asking you some of those long-range questions that perhaps it was impossible to ask in the format of the news show. Now, I was going to refer to the fact that on the editor's desk, Clarence Pendleton, chairman of President Reagan's Commission on Civil Rights, had appeared and made an interesting statement. He said, a lot of us assumed in 1963 when we marched with Dr. King that there would probably be one protected class in America, and that would be blacks. Since that time, the population of protected classes has grown to about 17. Approximately 75% of Americans now are covered by affirmative action laws and regulations. So it winds up being a zero-sum game. Do you think that has damaged the civil rights movement in terms of blacks?
I really don't know what Pendleton is talking about. When the equal opportunity laws were being passed, Howard Smith, we used to call him Judge Smith, who was a recalcitrant congressman from the South,
right,
put into the law women, you know, as well as blacks and other protected classes, thinking that it would defeat the law. And that's where he gets that 75% figure from, because obviously at least half of Americans are women. But the fact of the matter is, history will reveal and record that we have discriminated against women. When I was sitting as a criminal court judge, a black judge, the first in the South, in Memphis, Tennessee, here I was, a black man who had been discriminated against all of his life, and yet I fell in briefly, you know, with the white male lawyer idea that all women lawyers were, you know, somehow inferior and they didn't know how to present their cases. I found myself, you know, being caught up in that kind of thing, because our whole history has had men dominating women, you know, in this country. So that when we think in terms of people who need the protection of the law, it is a lot of people. There are rather a lot of people, and included in that class are women. Now, to the extent that there has been a charge made that women are being advanced faster than blacks, that is no more than an attempt to divide folk who ought to be allies.
But suppose one concedes that the statement is an attempt to divide would-be allies. Is it true, nevertheless?
I'm not sure of what he says being a net, not being a net gain. No, I don't agree with that. When I remember finishing law school in 1949, there was not a single black judge in the city of Memphis. Today there are nine, including the federal judge. There were no women judges. Today there are about seven. So that both women and men, black people, you know, have gained positions, including on that nine black judges are some black women. I don't understand. I mean, we've made remarkable progress, and I wouldn't ever want to deny the fact that because of the new opportunities opening up, my grandboys will have more to look forward to than I did. When I practiced law, had I told somebody in 1949 that I wanted to be a judge, or that I would have the opportunity on three separate occasions to turn down an appointment to the federal judgeship, you know, they would have thought I had lost my mind. So that women and blacks and other protected minorities have advanced. Now, if one says that white males are being discriminated against, you'd have to conclude that they were the only ones who should be judges, you know, as they were in 1949. It is true, if you had no black judges in Memphis, then those nine black spots filled by blacks would be filled by white males. But I don't think that is reverse discrimination or that there has been no net gain. The fact that we have 5,000 elected black officials is a net gain. The fact that we do have a number of blacks in positions they never held before is a net gain. And the fact that women have been included in the mix is a net gain for America.
It's interesting to me that you take that approach to the question of civil rights and question of blacks and the place of blacks in our country. Not so terribly long ago, Kenneth Clark was at this table. And I think that Dr. Clark's approach was, he wasn't unwilling to admit great progress, but he was somewhat despairing, somewhat, I think, less optimistic, less positive about the position of blacks today. How do you reconcile those?
Well, you see, I don't know Dr. Clark's background, but I came from nowhere to somewhere. I was born in Memphis in a completely segregated society. I went to an all-black grammar school, high school. I served in the 92nd Infantry Division, which was all black except for the officers who were all white, you know, above the rank of captain. I've seen the progress, and nobody's going to make me deny that progress. I see the problems now. I see the difficulties now. I understand the difference now is we will no longer have a Brown versus Board of Education case, which in one opinion can change the whole law. We now must implement it one piece by one piece. Akron, Ohio, Canton, Ohio, Memphis, Tennessee. I understand that we have equal opportunity employment laws, but that when we come to the various companies, we've got to deal with them one by one and job by job. Because I'm in the thick of the fight every day, there are days when I do become discouraged, but every now and then you have to stand back and not only see a forest, but you have to see trees. I would negate the history of the black accomplishment in America if I tried to pretend there was no progress.
You know, there was a quote from Vernon Jordan not so long ago. Black people are out of style. It's an interesting quotation. What do you think about it?
Well, I think that what Vernon was referring to is that there was a brief period, and Americans had those brief periods, when with a certain kind of clarity, like a light coming on in the darkness, we see Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation address, Thomas Jefferson's, you know, Declaration of Independence, which was a novel concept. You know, you think about participatory democracy back in 1774, 75, when all over this world we believed in the divine right of kings and peasants were tied to the land as serfs almost as bad as slavery. When you see this light shining through that gloom, we hold these truths to be self-evident. When you read the Emancipation Proclamation, when you read the amendment, I forget which one it was, adopted in 1920, giving women the right to vote. When you read the language of Lyndon Johnson as he talked about we shall overcome and equality results, every now and then America has a clear vision. And there was a period, a very brief period, when blacks were on the major agenda of America during the 60s, led by men such as Dr. King and Roy Wilkins and Whitney Young and Malcolm X and others. For a brief period of time, white America saw its error. And it's peculiar because King had a very peculiar philosophy. And white people have never understood that he paid them the greatest compliment that could ever be paid.
What do you mean?
Well, he maintained, and I was a member of his board and worked very closely with him, that in the Judeo-Christian philosophy of America, there was a conscience that could be reached. And that the only way to reach that conscience was to create tension. He would take a rubber band and stretch it. So with marches and demonstrations, he was trying to reach the conscience of America. The film Gandhi is the best example. Mahatma Gandhi did a lot of things through, you know, passive resistance and through starvation diets. But one would have to be a fool to have believed that that kind of tactic would work with Hitler. You know, because with Hitler, he could have gone on a starvation diet and died. It wouldn't have bothered him. The compliment that King paid to white America was that they did indeed have a conscience. You know, hidden, devious, oblivious. They walked over black folk. They enslaved them and sold them. But King had this profound belief that if you could stretch that band enough and create enough tension, that white America would respond. And indeed, they did. And the tragedy of King's life was he had to die before people understood it. I put together a study group in Memphis of the editors of the paper, and the general managers of television stations, the presidents of the big universities, the national banks. And one of the things that I asked them to do when we came together after Dr. King was killed in Memphis is would they take the time to read a few books? And the first book I gave them was a book by W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker Washington and Jane and Roseman Johnson, the brother, and they read that book. Then I asked them to read Why We Can't Wait and Strive to Freedom by King. And these white men, captains of industry and educators, sat at that table one morning and cried because they said they had never understood what King was about until he was dead. They had never heard him speak. You know, they heard the newspapers saying, here comes this agitator. So the King had this peculiar philosophy, and the NAACP, by the way, had the same philosophy and a different mood. We believed that we could go to court. And remember that the Supreme Court, under Warren, that ruled 9-0 in Brown versus Board of Education in our favor, was an all-white Supreme Court, appointed by many different presidents. Remember also that Thurgood Marshall won more cases before the Supreme Court than any lawyer in the history of this nation. so that we also had this belief, this deeply ingrained belief that because of the Constitution, because of the nature of the Revolution, even though black folk were excluded, you know, in practice, we always believed we were included in principle, and that we had to do what it took, whether it was marches, demonstrations, boycotts, or legal action, to force America to come to grips with itself. We have succeeded up to a point. Now, that does not mean to say, and I perhaps agree with Dr. Clark, if he is saying that we still have a long way to go, because we're far from equality.
But you know, on the open mind, over the years, we've been here 27 years, and I sat here talking to Martin Luther King, to Malcolm X, to Roy Wilkins, to Kenneth Clark, to Thurgood Marshall. And I wonder if today you feel there are the likes of those men. You talked about a light shining. Where does that light come from today?
I think that history sometimes gives people more recognition after their deaths, or after their, you know, legendary days, than it does during those days. Thurgood Marshall is a good example. Certainly, he won more cases, you know, than anybody else. But he was not universally recognized as a great lawyer because people had a prejudice, I mean, many white people, when they looked at him. Roy Wilkins will perhaps be more recognized in years to come by the general population. I don't mean perceptive people like you who sit, you know, where news is being made and generated. I don't mean that kind of recognition, but among masses of people. Martin King was more appreciated in death than life. But that's true also of white people. A man wrote me a letter during my recent crisis, and we said, in which he said that we have a peculiar philosophy in America. One generation murders its leaders, and the next generation erects monuments. And I think that has a lot of truth. Abraham Lincoln was one of the most vilified of all American presidents, you know, during his lifetime. It's unbelievable, and I'm a sort of a student of Lincoln, what papers said about him: a buffoon, a monkey, a clown, a gorilla, everything you wanted to think of. But when he got killed, even in the South, where they despised him, they came to appreciate his greatness and his genius. So that when you ask, are there people on the scene today, I have wondered about that. I don't see a Franklin Roosevelt. I wonder what's happened to white people. Where are the great people? Where is the Thomas Jefferson of the day? What has happened to the white males? Why can't we produce the likes, you know, of a George Washington, Abraham Lincoln? What has happened to the white population? What has happened to their mind? I almost despair when I look at white people of today and remember the great white folk of yesterday. I wonder, where are they? Where is the Edward R. Murrow? You know, where is the man who's willing to risk his whole career during the MacArthur era? Where are the lawyers that stood up there? Where is the George C. Marshall, that great military genius? You know, where is the Harry Truman who stood up, you know, to the Russians and the Iron Curtain thing? Where are the Winston Churchills of the world? I wonder if we aren't producing a generation of mediocre people. But then I stop and think and say, well, maybe 20 years from now they'll look back and find somebody in this present crowd who has achieved greatness. But I feel somewhat like you. I'm beginning to wonder, have white folk in the Western world forfeited their leadership? Have they lost all their great minds? I wonder about that.
And your conclusion?
Well, my conclusion is that maybe I'm a victim of that same type of historical, you know, perspective, that we don't recognize the Caesars among us. We don't recognize the Martin Kings and the Frederick Douglasses. We don't recognize the Walt Whitman until time has passed. I'm not even sure that Shakespeare was as great in his lifetime as he is now.
It's funny, I was mentioning to you before that when Martin Luther King sat at this table with Judge J. Rady's Waring, my task was to introduce him to a New York audience, I must grant, who had no sense of who he might be. But such is fame. Let me move my question to something that relates to that. My friends at the Wall Street Journal editorialized not so long ago when the president nominated three people to the United States Civil Rights Commission, and it was a great outcry. And your group and other groups protested the naming of these three people, though they were three people who had been involved in the civil rights movement in the past, but on a different level, with a different a focal point, perhaps. And the Journal went on to say about the people who had protested the nomination by the president. He said, these leaders, they have now achieved their major goals, black leaders essentially, and the case for some of their new demands, say allotting minorities a specific share of federal procurement contracts, is much weaker than those earlier insistences on anti-discrimination laws. Do you think that perforce the civil rights movement is weakened in terms of gaining white support by the fact that what you have said has been accomplished, has been accomplished?
But you know, let me just say this, the Wall Street Journal ought to be absolutely ashamed of itself. You know, we forget history so quickly. You remember after the Revolutionary War, and the ties were broken with England, that you could have a pair of shoes made in England, shipped across 3,000 miles of the ocean, bought in New York, much cheaper and much better than shoes made here in America. So we erected a tariff wall in order to protect American industry so it could grow. And shoes in America that would break your feet up were sold at a higher price, because there was a feeling among the founding fathers and mothers of this country that without that high tariff wall, we would never develop our industry. Now, we did that. They are talking now about a domestic content law because we're afraid of imports, you know, in various kinds of things. And yet when it comes to black people seeking their place in the sun, all of a sudden we forget all about our history, the great tariff walls we erected until we could do that. It's the same principle. When we ask the federal government to set aside a certain amount of its, procurement contracts for black business people, it is not something that is the last forever. But like the tariff, you know, a wall behind which you can get started in order that you can compete. The day came when in America we could make shoes as quickly, as efficiently, and as well as they could in England, and you no longer needed a tariff wall. But let me just say one other thing. 80% of the defense contracts in this country are non-competitive. I testified not long ago before a congressional committee, and they asked, how long will black people want this protection? I said, well, about as long as McDonnell Douglas and Lockheed and Boeing, you know, they've been getting non-competitive defense contracts, cost-plus contracts, since 1941, 42 years. But because they're white and because they're a majority of people, nobody ever questions them. They build some kind of big pipe, one part in California, the other in New York, and when they came together, it wouldn't fit. We got helicopters that won't run and rifles that won't shoot. You know, we've got all kinds of mistakes and malfunctions. We've got cost overruns. I spent 5 years in Washington, and I saw the whining and the dining that's charged the taxpayers. Nobody raises those questions, but when black people come up and ask for a little bitty piece of the pie to give us a chance to get started, not forever, not in perpetuity, as they do with some of these big defense contractors, but a small piece of the pie and a little wall of protection, so we can become a part of the American mainstream. No nation in the Western world, according to Tonbee, the great English historian who recently died, has ever succumbed to outside military force. But all of them have succumbed from weaknesses from within. You cannot build a great nation when 10% of its people are permanently economically underclass. And that is the problem today. We have achieved these things I talked about, some political power. We've eliminated the separate restrooms, et cetera, et cetera. But when it comes to the economy, 10% of Americans are unemployed, but in the black community, it's 20%. And that's what we must work on.
But that brings me then to a question that is of enormous importance. There are those who say that the crucial question that we have to deal with here is class rather than race. Do you feel that that's true? Economic divisions rather than color divisions?
This question comes up all the time, and I cannot really get it into the proper context because, you know, when you really get down to it, in gross numbers, there are more poor white people in this nation than there are poor black people.
Mm-hmm.
The Census Bureau says that 30% of the blacks live at or below the level of poverty, that's 9 million, while only 10% of the white population lives at that level, but that's 18 million. So there are twice as many poor white people as poor black people. We talk about structural unemployment. We talk about all kinds of, you know, big economic terms, but the fact of the matter is that I don't see it as a class struggle. Or some black people maintain that there are black people who are not as well off now as they were before the so-called Civil Rights Revolution. And I absolutely deplore that statement. How can anybody say, when I lived, a black person lived in the South and could not drink from a water fountain, couldn't buy a hamburger at the front door, is worse off now? I mean, there are matters of spirit as well as matters of finance. But settle one part, we've got to go to the other part now.
But aren't there those who say that within the black community itself, there is a division between class? Poor people, wealthier people or middle class people, that in a sense undermines the strength of the whole civil rights movement.
Well, I don't think, as I said, but I think it's a falsehood. It's an absolute lie. And it's for a very peculiar reason. Anybody who read Eric Hayter's book would recognize it, that black people have such close family relationships that a black millionaire will probably have a brother or sister, nephew or niece, who's on the welfare rolls. You know, so we have not reached the place, I suspect, I don't want to call the names, in the Rockefeller clan, the Ford family, the Mellon family, that unless they gave that money away, you know, all of them are pretty well off, depend upon what you mean by well off, of whether a millionaire who only has 1 million is as well off as a billionaire.
I'd say so.
In the black community, we never get very far away, you know, from our poor relations, our family, the people that we love and circle around, so that why is it, if the class distinction is there, why is it that Mr. Reagan's program, which is tilted as far as I'm concerned toward the rich, has only attracted in the public opinion polls about 5% of the black population? You know, if there's really a class distinction, there are 20% of black people unemployed today, but there are 80% employed. 30% of black Americans live at the level of poverty, 70% don't. But you'll find that in most communities in which you go, the black population in political reality is almost monolithic. They vote for the most liberal candidate, for the candidate who promises to do the most for the people. And I think that this whole business of class distinction has been overrated. I do think, however, that the day will come in America, in this kind of capitalist society that Mr. Reagan is creating, where the rich are getting richer. You know, he really says this. If you're rich, the only way to make you work harder is to make sure you take home more. So therefore, they're going to reduce your taxes so you can take more home. But if you're poor, the only way to make you work harder is to tax your unemployment benefits so you have a stimulus to work. Now, any administration that thinks like that will eventually create class distinctions in this country. It will not, however, I don't think that philosophy will prevail very long. Certainly, there have always been class distinctions in the world since I've been reading about history, and there have been in America. In the Depression, there were people giving $100,000 parties while people were literally starving outside the mansion doors. But in terms of the black community, I think there's a closer relationship of cohesion based on the extended family that Eric Hayter talked about in that great book that still exists very strongly in the black community.
Mr. Hooks, one of the areas of dispute in this whole question of liberalism, whole question of civil rights movement, has been the sense that there is a division now between blacks and their major supporters back in the old days, the Jewish community. And this comes essentially at the level of quotas. Now, what's your feeling about this matter of this division?
Well, there's no question about the fact that I happen to chair the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights, which is about 30 years old, founded by Roy Wilkins and the late Philip Randolph and Arnold Aronson, who is Jewish and who still lives, by the way. And that was a very close-knit relationship, but when it came to affirmative action and the use of the word quotas, and I've tried to explain 100 times that a quota, by definition, in terms of race relations, was a ceiling above one which one could not rise. In NAACP, we talk about goals and timetables. When I was at the FCC, I was Equal Opportunity Employment Commissioner. If a television station employed 300 people, and they were all white and all male, I'm just making a hypothetical,
right,
and I would say to them, you've got to employ some blacks and some women, they could have said to me, from now to the year 2000, we cannot find anybody. And as long as they could say that, then they would always have a white male staff. So what we did was adopt reasonable goals and timetables. We said to them, all right, you've got this all white male, you know, workforce. That never really happened. I'm just making a hypothetical. So that by February 1st, 1974, 1 year from the day, we expect you to have X number of blacks and X numbers of women employed, and they must be spread among them. That became a remedial situation. It is the same thing that happens when they tell you that you not to exceed 55 miles an hour, you know, out there on a highway. You have to have a penalty for the violation of the law, else it is no law.
But Mr. Hooks, you're a brilliant communicator. Why haven't you been able to communicate that very understandable position to the Jewish community in a way that would lead them to understand that you weren't putting ceilings, you're putting floors?
Well, the problem has been twofold. When I first came to New York City, we used to engage in dialogue rather regularly with the established Jewish leadership of the major Jewish organizations. And I had made a standing promise to them, which has not been, they've not been able to deal with as yet. If you can tell me any other way than goals and timetables that black folk can break into the mainstream, then give me that remedy, and if it works, we'll accept it. Until another remedy works, we are forced to work with a remedy that will work. We said that in public buildings, you must keep the temperature at 68. Mr. Carter, as president, proclaimed that. Now, patriotic people might do it, but the real reason is there's some penalty, you know, in terms of escalator clauses if you exceed the usage and so forth. The car companies now are going to be penalized because they started building bigger cars, and federal law says your average of, you know, mile per gallon must be so much. And up to this point, nobody, white or black, Jew or Gentile, Clarence Pendleton or Clarence Thomas or anybody else that has been named black or white, has been able to come up with any remedy, you know, that's better than goals and timetables. And I will stick with it. Why? I can understand the historic aversion of the Jewish community to the word quota. I understand that very well. It was used to deny them their legitimate place in the sun. We've also gotten into all these other kinds of non-job related tests. There's no correlation beyond the first year of college between doing exceptionally well on scholastic aptitude tests and being a good student. There's no guarantee that the doctor who finished first in his or her class will be the best doctor. In West Point, I think MacArthur was the only general we ever had, you know, who finished first in his class. And there were many of us who thought, I don't want to go into MacArthur. If Eisenhower had been promoted on the basis of his scholarship at West Point, he would have died a lieutenant colonel. So that, you know, all of these tests we've devised have not dealt with reality. So what I'm saying is we will attempt to continue to communicate to the Jewish community our concern in this matter.
Mr. Hooks, thank you so much for joining me today. And thanks, too, to you and the audience. I hope that you'll join us again here on The Open Mind. Meanwhile, as an old friend used to say, good night and good luck.